You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Daniela Mestinek-Young. We've had her on the show before, and it was so great to talk to her before, and I am so looking forward to talking to her today. She truly is fascinating. She is an American author and speaker who was raised in the religious cult called Children of God, a cult that I was introduced to through people coming to my office in the late 80s and 90s saying that they had been involved in this organization. And it was mind-bending to hear about all that they had been through within this group. So it's a group that I have cared a lot about and wondered a lot about and worried a lot about when it came to the people raised in it for quite some time now. Daniela later served as an intelligence officer for the U.S. Army for over 6 years, making the rank of captain and becoming one of the first women in U.S. Army history to conduct deliberate ground combat operations when she volunteered to serve on a female engagement team and received the Presidential Volunteer Service Award. Daniela lives with her husband and daughter in Maryland and holds a master's degree in industrial and organizational psychology from the Harvard Extension School. She published her memoir, Uncultured, and her latest book is The Culting of America, What Makes a Cult and Why We Love Them. The book description says that most of us think we'd never fall for a cult. We picture robes, chanting, and remote compounds, but toxic groups don't just exist on the fringe. They thrive in boardrooms and group chats and fitness classes, political rallies, religious groups, and corporate retreats, actually. Anywhere we seek identity and purpose and belonging. The Culting of America reveals how cultish behavior isn't just thriving in modern life, it's hiding in plain sight. What Daniela wants to impart on us is that whether you're part of a church, a company, a fandom, or political movement, the question isn't if you're in a cultic kind of group, but it's how much of yourself you've already lost. Here's Daniela now. It is a total delight to have Daniela Mestenek Young back with us on the show. It is so good to see you, to check in with you, to see how life is going, to find out about your book and all that's been happening, or at least however much we have time to talk about today. So I'd love you to take a moment to reintroduce yourself, or to introduce yourself to the people who haven't heard you before on this show, and then we'll start talking. So go for it.
Absolutely. I am Daniela, scholar of cults, extreme groups, and extremely bad leadership. And I grew up in the Children of God religious cult. I was actually born three generations into the Children of God. And the Children of God is the one that is generally famous for sexual abuse of children, and for having famous child actors like River Phoenix and Rose McGowan and Joaquin. And I was one of those little acting, dancing children. My first book, Uncultured, that I wrote was about growing up in that situation and then getting out, coming to America, and then going into the U.S. Army, which I looked at also as a pretty significant cult experience and sort of measured the two. Since the last time I came on the show, I went back to school and got a master's in organizational psychology. And then I did my three-year research project, which I called The Culting of America. And it was breaking down this 10-part model of cult and showing it in real cults or recognized cults in American society and in the military. What I think I've done here is written sort of a cult tactics book. This is how they do it and how they get you. And we can understand each tactic on its own without necessarily having to call one group a cult or not and sort of diagnose things in that way.
So interesting. So yeah, I want us to be able to talk about organizational psychology because it's not something that has been covered on this show. We've talked about psychology. We've talked about existential psychology, which leads a lot of people to want to get involved in cults and dealing with issues around life and death and freedom and all of it. Social psychology, we've talked about, but not organizational psychology. And that is fascinating. And I think through me doing this work, while I haven't studied it to the degree that you have in a more intensive way in a program, there is probably something to having studied so many different groups where I can sometimes predict what the methods of control were or what's going to happen next without necessarily knowing the terms for it, but just the scene that repeats itself, which is really interesting. So I'd love you to teach us about some of the terms that you learned about in organizational psychology that apply here that, as I'm sure you're saying them, people will say, oh, that's what that is.
It was interesting because I even knew I was kind of doing this with Uncultured, where I said, I think I want to show people that as cult kids, we understand more about organizations just kind of inherently than a lot of other people do. You know, I think I just think in groups. And one of the hardest things to do was say I and not we in Uncultured. That's what I think this whole book is doing. So social norms would be one of the terms, you know, and very specifically social proof. We think we are rational human beings. We really do. But research shows us that we tend to make our decisions based on two things: recency bias, what worked the most recently, and social proof, what everyone else is doing. So in my craziest example of this, in the Children of God, the second lady in command came out with this doctrine about loving Jesus, which was basically having spiritual sex with Jesus. They sent out a very specific instruction with this 12-part doctrine, which was nobody was allowed to read it for the first time by themselves. And this is tapping in to social proof. If you were by yourself, you would probably say, this is crazy. But you're seeing these other people whom you love and respect around you, and nobody's saying anything. And everyone is thinking, okay, so it's not that bad. I mean, we've all kind of been in that situation in a workplace, probably.
Yeah, we have. That is so interesting. Oh, on so many levels. It's reminding me of Scientology, where you're not supposed to go to this level, OT3, where you learn about their sacred doctrine, which is about Xenu and galactic warriors, et cetera, et cetera. They say that you can get cancer and other things if you expose yourself to this before you're ready. Before you're ready is really translated to before you're programmed. Before you're programmed to not question it, but also you're supposed to do it as part of an exercise with someone who's teaching you, I think, like what you're saying, left to your own devices, independent research would cause you to say, I'm sorry, what? So often people will say, I walked into a room and I saw people in adoration of the person who was speaking and they're smiling and nodding their heads. And I thought there must be something to this because of that. And there must be something wrong with me that I'm not seeing it that way. It's very interesting. That's our default.
One of the things that got me into this originally was this research that shows that people who do public speaking make more money across industry than people who don't. And I immediately heard that and I went, what am I an expert on? And I said, you know what? Growing up in a cult and being a woman in the military. But I have called this front of the room advantage. When someone has handed you the mic, we in the audience are sitting there, you know, listening to your bio, which you wrote yourself, about how cool you are. And we're thinking, yeah, Rachel's great. You can sort of engineer that. I used to teach veterans, hey, get yourself in front of the mic and then people will think you deserve to be there. So these are all tools that people can use in a lot of different ways. And I just really look at, I decided after leaving the Army as where I was the intelligence officer, the expert on the bad guy. During my graduate degree, I was like, I want to continue to focus on the bad guy and bad leadership and coercive control, because that's what I inherently understand. You know, everyone said like, well, wait, what are you going to do with that bad leadership? And I was like, well, that's what we do in the Army. We study the bad guy in order to understand what they're going to do next and how we protect ourselves. So it's funny because I went and I studied groups. I do think, as you said, like we haven't really had a group psychology perspective applied to cults in this way. But I ended up deciding, I don't know if I really care about the groups. I think I still ultimately care about helping individuals understand groups that have hurt them in the past, groups that are hurting them now, avoid groups that might want to hurt them in the future. And also, since you brought up the aliens, I have to mention that one of my very serious things in the book that I talk about is how cults always promise space travel. It was when the Space Force was founded, and I was like, oh no, it's culty. The children of God had their own doctrine about heaven being inside the moon. And you have the Mormons with their planet and the Scientologists where they just made up a whole space world. I was like, what is it about space travel? I think it's actually fundamental to coercive control, that there's this super big mission, which I address in chapter 3 of the book. There's some sort of transformation. There's some sort of on another body, on another planet, in another life, in another state, in another dimension, the promise that is essentially never going to be actually fulfilled. I've even found in single family cults, sometimes it was a trip to Disney World. So like Space Mountain.
That's very interesting. There's also something about that where you can't disprove it. It just is out there as this mission or this promise, this fantasy. But because you haven't seen the interior of the moon, you don't know what's there. Well, you can assume what's there and all that's not there. but you don't know. And so then you go to, I guess, this idea of, like, you're talking about social proof. The people are saying that it is the truth. So you go, okay, I'm not going to the moon anytime soon to be able to disprove this.
It's funny because I say it very unserious and I make bumper stickers called Stars Promise Space Travel, but it's led me to have at least very serious conversations with my own daughter, who's kind of a spooky little spiritual kid and very interested in what comes after death. And I'm just not that way. I never have been. I'm here in this life. So one of the conversations I've had with her is about heaven and believing in heaven and why can't I? And I said, if it helps you, you can totally believe in heaven, and that most people believe that those who love each other will find each other again in some way. But I then follow that with, but just don't let someone convince you to compromise things in this life because of their promise of what comes after space travel.
There are so many things that you have probably said and that I have sure said, where after it comes out of your mouth, you're thinking, what? I've gotten so used to saying the similar with conspiratorial thinking. Oh, lizard people, you know, okay, must be Tuesday. What? It's reminding me of Heaven's Gate. And something that I've talked about on the podcast before was this video that they did right before they all died, talking about how awful the world was and how they're so happy and so relieved to go to the mothership to be releasing their bodies, and a lot of other euphemisms that are about death, but they don't use the word death, I think, so that they don't have the typical emotional and physiological response. They can stay detached by using other language around it. But what was so sad and fascinating while watching this video, which came out after they died, was you had people usually in partnership, two people, that they didn't do these interviews alone. But they had another person there, similar to going back to your original point, and talking about how the world is so dark and lonely and how they can't wait to go to where it's pristine and wonderful. Meanwhile, they're sitting in a backyard of this house in San Diego. There are flowers, they're literally butterflies going by. They're with someone who they're smiling at. And I'm thinking, you have friends, you have beauty, just turn around. Just don't be here, but be here and notice what's really the truth about your life and about the world. It was so head spinning and so sad that they couldn't see what was right in front of them because they needed to be so excited about the promise of what was going to be, as opposed to what they have right now. They have a whole group of friends and they have beauty and butterflies. Just turn around and look.
It's right here, right? Heaven on earth. This language of detachment is so important. And my brain is already like, when I do my paperback launch, I'm going to need to get an essay from you on the language of detachment, because I have a whole chapter on types of language that cults use. I hadn't thought about that one specifically and how they get you to detach. And going back to your other point, talking about the cults forcing your excitement on their mission and their issue all of the time. I was talking with my mom about this. We do our little deconstruction together. And she's like, yeah, like you were always supposed to be like high on Jesus in the children of God. You always had to be obsessed with that one thing. Here's what I think is interesting is when people ask me, how do you protect yourself or your children, especially from coercive groups or even coercive individuals, because you can have a 1-1 cult. My best answer is you can't ever devote yourself 100% to any person, place, thing, or idea, not even fighting fascism, which I have to keep reminding myself. But if you can't hold something back for yourself, you're going to get exploited and coerced by these groups that you're going to encounter in your life.
Absolutely right. Oh, I love that you get to talk to your mom about this. Now, that's so good. And that you get to talk to your spiritual witchy daughter about all of this is fantastic too. Interesting, lovely family.
I don't know if we sent you, but I would very much like to send you because I made a deconstruction workbook.
Oh, nice.
Because here I give you these 10 things that I say make up a cult. And so we did a matching intended to help you like deconstruct that worldview that cults give you and that pseudo identity that cults require you to put on. I've been working through it to deconstruct Swiftianity and being a Swiftie, and it has actually gotten me into some pretty deep places.
Okay, that's great. I want to put a link to that too, so we'll get that information. But that's a Swiftie. Yeah, I have a cousin who got engaged at a Taylor Swift concert, is a big fan, is all of it, follows her around. Yeah, it's in my family too.
And I talk about this in the book, and I'd be interested to get your theory, because I think fandoms are identities. Being a Swiftie is an identity, like being a Christian or being a Muslim. This is where I use this in my chapter at the end, where I'm like, just groups. They're all just groups, and it's how we look at them. And I'm not sure that anyone has really done like fan, because fan groups aren't really groups, you know, the sort of like individual behavior sometimes acted out in public. I was a super Swiftie for 20 years, but I never interacted in a group in any sort of way, not even a concert.
I'm happy to talk through more about fandom. I think it is an identity. I think it also can shift over time, when sometimes those identities work for you or are more needed to make you feel stable, to make you feel connected, to pierce isolation, to give you a sense of belonging in a way that you might not always need, but it serves that purpose then. And I think it can be healthy in its own way to give you that sense of connectedness, as long as it doesn't become unhealthy, because any group has the potential, just depending on who's running it. I know that with my family, some of my kids are, well, one is much more mainstream, the other's out there. What I think is very interesting is that there are people out there who will capitalize on that. People who will say, oh, here's my opportunity to get what I need by jumping in and kind of running this, as opposed to letting people be. They just can't let people be. It's just so selfish. I'm thinking also, I heard a woman talk about how she was raised in a family cult, a multi-generational family cult in the woods. They were only allowed to have collective emotions, which was a fascinating subject to get into, that the person in charge, who was the grandfather, would say, today we are all sad. And then they'd all be sad. So to be so detached, that's another kind of language of detachment. You are feeling this. You're allowed to feel that. Any other emotion that came up, you would find a way to bat it away because it was not allowed. But just to know that you could only have communal feelings is kind of a fascinating thing.
You know what has been very interesting for me as I have done my own journey and my own healing from a childhood in a cult has been, it seems like a different person that all of that happened to, because I think we're so detached. I remember it was after I had written Uncultured, and I had the realization toward the end of my graduate degree, after actually studying situational identity theory, and going, oh, I never got to form a personal identity. That's what you're doing between the ages of 1 and 6. And I was growing up in a cult with absolute group emotions and only ever happy ones, as this child performer, performing just perfection all of the time. But I was actually this neurodivergent, witchy child myself that needed to do completely different things. It does occur to me that that's at least a good thing. That means I'm learning to live a lot more in my body and in my life. And so these stories all seem like they happened to almost a different person.
That is exciting that you can see how much of that life was performative, how much of it was cultivated for survival and to fit in and to not stand out and to not be on the hot seat. I think it is a wonderful thing to get to know yourself, just to reveal. It's like when you have children, as you've experienced, with each birthday or each year that passes, you get to know her in a whole new way as she gets to know her and develops. And now for you to have that outside of the group, outside of the military, where you can say, I wonder who Daniela is, given the opportunity to just be Daniela and to meet yourself, is probably this fascinating and exciting process.
It has been fascinating and exciting. And it also explained the Taylor Swift of it all, because there I was, 18 years old, completely alone in the world, scratching to get my life together after growing up in a cult. Here was this performing evangelical young woman with all that charisma and all that everything. I got to this in my deconstruction workbook, where I was like, I wasn't seeing her as a leader. I was seeing her as an alternate me, I think, if I hadn't had that trauma. And let me tell you, one of the things in my journey is I have written a musical, the cult musical, veterans included. I was at a showing of Hamilton, and I was like, oh, I have to do that to be on that stage. That's the culmination of my life in the performance cult. And then I took it to my audience, where I knit and talk to them about cults and their experiences. When I tell you, everyone wants to be in the musical, all of the cult babies and all of the veterans. And performance is this absolute through line of like what we all learned to do and what we all have to like unlearn. But also performance, actual performance, was some of the only times that we were free, at least for me and the children of God. The only time I could scream at the top of my lungs was when I was doing a ripa, baila la bamba, opening up a show. And so I did. And so we all have that ability, I think, to perform and throw ourselves into stuff, which has been fascinating.
That is really fascinating. I'm thinking now, as you're talking about the children of God, some of my first families I ever worked with were children of God families. This is in the late 80s. And it was very hard. Lots of children born in lots of countries without birth certificates or medical care. A lot to address all at once. And I'm thinking about all the things that people brought into me, the mimeograph, like the blue ink, the copies that were sent out of the drawings, the comic sort of drawings of couples and love, etc. I mean, it's very creepy now when you look at it. And I'm also thinking that a number of years ago, after I was on the show Seduced about NXIVM, there were a number of former NXIVM members who decided to do a comedy show where they wanted to just create jokes about what they had been through. And it's a lovely distancing technique and empowering way of saying, I get to laugh at it. I also get to laugh at you.
Now that I've written the whole thing and realized what I've done, is this 3 hours of fun, funny, teaching you how programming works and how deconstruction works and how healing works, but also like giving you the secrets. There's this one point where the sexy youth pastor and the sexy Marine recruiter come out and give you their pitch. And then they look at each other and back at the audience and they're like, didn't you know that sex appeal is always part of recruiting?
Right. You know? Right, exactly.
I'm like having fun. I'm creating it with my audience. I am using a bunch of Children of God's sassy beats that I was made to perform in my childhood for no pay, taking it back and writing these sort of parody songs. And I think it's going to be really fun. It's at least been a fun project to work on.
Really fun. Can you, I don't want you to give anything away, except I would love a sample very briefly of a sassy beat that you could just do off the cuff.
Yeah, it's the elevator pitch. So I can't express enough. The first two lines of this are directly from a cult song. So I've brought out 10 cult characters and put them on a chessboard. And then they start with, heaven's girls and heaven's boys, making such a joyful noise. Is it a cult? Is it a creed? Is it the truth or what we need?
Ooh, okay.
On the army side, I've brought out 10 cult military women and put them on a chessboard. And then I have my favorite song, the Army Basic Training song called Drink the Kool-Aid. And it's Army's girls and Army's boys. Quit making such an awful noise. Recruiter said you would have fun. Nope. Basic training has begun.
Wow. I love that. That's perfect. Basic training has begun.
Funny, irreverent. I'm using puppets. The children are puppets because I won't make more child actors and because cult children are puppets. And I'm using a bunch of lines from different musicals and things and doing a pastiche. And it's like my commentary on the fact that everything from cults is stolen and hacked and repurposed, and throwing in some deconstruction of racism and the patriarchy, and set it all to a sick beat. There's this video that is still on YouTube of me as a 10-year-old and six other white children rapping apocalypse Bible verses in downtown Rio. We're repossessing that, but also we're starting with bad Christian rap because that's what we were appropriating. But as you go through the journey, the rap gets more and more sophisticated till the end is just like really cool.
That's so cool. I'm sure just that video, I'd love to see it. I'm sure it's cringy.
It is cringy. But it was also interesting because when I started sharing that video where it's like, it lives on YouTube sort of for our history's sake, somebody from the regular like evangelical world was like, oh my gosh, I used to watch that growing up. And I never understood, speaking of like attitude and behavior control, like how they got you to do that. This is also when I realized that performance is such a great way to traffic children. Because my first reaction is like, how did they get us to do it? I mean, they beat us and assaulted us and trained us only for that purpose from birth. But that's not what we look like. We just look like super into Jesus 10-year-olds who are in a family band.
So I wonder, too, about these techniques of influence. And one of the techniques being that basically, when they have people go out and talk about how great something is or trying to recruit someone for something, if you are an honorable person, but also if you're someone who can, after repeating something over and over again, can be talked into believing that it's the truth, just having people perform things in a convincing way for applause, for money, for whatever it is inherently built into that. Is it that they're trying to get you to convince yourself by repeating it, by convincing the people who are listening?
And to be performing all the time. And when I first got on the internet, started answering people's questions, people were asking me that. What is it about cult and performance, right? Like David Koresh had a good band. The Children of God very famously had a whole music program and a Fleetwood Mac guy. And I was thinking about it, and it was watching the Duggars. Jim Bob Duggar had those kids so well trained that he knew he could bring in an entire camera crew and none of those kids were going to break rank and talk about the abuses, because everything is performance all of the time. And this is why it's like, whether the people in my audience were the performing kids or were just the regular kids, they all get the performance thing, the like having to perform, the mission all of the time.
And I also think that when you're performing, you can appear happy. So you give the guise of having a great life, a life that looks so upbeat, where you're all connected. Also, when people are singing and dancing together, they do seem connected, like they are one unit, like they're a community, they're a family. It's reminding me of this movie that was done about the cult Shinrikyo. And this filmmaker, or the filmmakers, asked me to come and do a Q&A at the Alemly Theater nearby me. I actually learned a lot about the cult by watching this documentary. And one of the things I didn't know at the time, I wasn't following the story as closely as I guess I should have been at the time that it was happening. I only found out after the sarin gas attack and when a lot of other people found out about the group. But they had an entertainment troupe. They had people doing singing and dancing and costuming and They went out with masks on and they were on floats and parades looking so, so, so happy. People clapping along and singing along and were learning some of their songs. Now, you know, come to think that it's so despicable.
One of the things we look at in the book is that cults are always about labor. They're essentially organized crime that are trafficking labor. And there's four really easy ways to do that in this country. And one of them is performance, the entertainment. I watch Quiet on set about these Hollywood kids. Oh, we were just way down here on that unpaid end of it. But a lot of it is these very, very similar trends. What is pretty interesting about writing this book and then going on the internet to talk to people about all these individual tactics and things is finding that huge amounts of Americans have had exposure to these same kinds of coercive techniques that cults are using, just maybe not all 10 of them all at once, in the ways that these recognize cult experiences. And I've certainly also found out that there are way more single-family cults and one-to-one cult relationships than we're ever going to be able to know and diagnose out there.
Oh, absolutely right. So many of them are in spaces where you don't know that there's a cult there. It could be the house next door. Also, there's this other part that makes it hard to expose how many cults there are out there, because I think, first of all, the language is different, so you don't realize you're being abused and neglected and harmed in a whole variety of ways. You think you're being specially chosen or cured in some way or loved in that way. But it feels to me like what I've seen is that people get very good at appearing a certain way, appearing fine, then are disconnected in that way, I think, from themselves and become almost afraid. They become afraid of exposing the truth about how they feel, about who they are. Because I think when you grow up hearing that you do need to hide it, you can start to feel that there's some shame around it, or that there is something worthy of keeping hidden, or that you will no longer be acceptable in society if people see you. I wonder about that part of just appearing a certain way, having to kind of merge yourselves or have that inner person come out, and what that process was like for you, how much fear also was involved in that.
You know, it's interesting that you used the word appear so many times, because in the book, I look at appearance control as a tool of behavior control, followed by attitude control. And all of that is in the chapter on self-sacrifice and how they break you and how they disconnect you from yourself. Is this always having to appear perfect in whatever way that group has designated their perfection? And I also look at this thing that I just call purity requirements, which is not, of course, just sexual purity, but any binary, we don't do XYZ. We don't put it in our hair, in our bodies, in our children, in our minds. It becomes this purity requirement. And you're never good enough. Purity requirements are good for cult leaders because humans are bad at being pure and perfect. We're bad at it. So they define purity in their way. The cult leader, of course, never has to follow their own purity requirements. But they keep you this constantly striving.
And I think so often how much this is all missing the point. It's like your car is breaking down, you're hearing horrible sounds, smoke is coming out of it, and you bring it in, and they say, well, let's just give it a better paint job and buff out things on the outside, and then it'll seem fine. But you still have something very broken and destructive and even dangerous happening on the inside. So here you're supposed to seem fine, look polished, but you're also being abused. And the people who are abusing you can also come across as glossy, and no one gets to the point. No one gets to the inside.
You asked me what my experience was like, and I say my number one warning signs, if children are like too well-behaved, and not like an individual child, because some children are just little adults all the time, but a group of children, it's still hard for me to talk about like the FBI officers at Waco falling over themselves about how well-behaved these four-year-old Branch Davidian kids were, that they would sit in the middle of the night for hours to listen to David talking. And you just want to be like, that's not well-behaved. That's abuse. And I actually have some pretty strong feelings about the difference between brainwashing children and adults. As children, we're just born into that. We don't have the program run on us. We're just thrown into the pool. And we just have to figure it out with whatever tools we have as children. Plus, as you say, we're sort of being abused and being programmed. And I have found in one well-researched cult survivor's book a term for this, which is actually called mind rape, when you isolate a child and completely control them, as was done to us. But I think that brainwashing is just getting your subject to agree to stop asking questions, to stop even going there in their mind. And I think that with adults, we buy into our own brainwashing. And so my experience was that I don't think I ever believed in God. I think I was just a neurodivergent atheist born to religious extremists. And there was really nothing the children of God could do to make me believe it. And they tried all the things. And I was just always completely aware that I'm performing this role and playing this game just until I can get out of here. I was just their prisoner. You know, I wasn't really a cult survivor. And I think most cults, the big ones at least, realize at some point they have to break the teenagers. They have to get you, once your mind is developed enough to have more rationality, to rationalize yourself into it. So when I joined the army, first day, I'm like, oh, this is a cult. But like, that's okay. I'm going to be better than these other people. And Daniela, you signed up for this. And I bought in to the whole soldier identity thing. So that's my theory, that you can't really brainwash young children, because young children just ask why all the time. And this is why almost all the cults end up with this iron grip on controlling children, because you have to do that until they get to the age where you can then get them to buy in and choose it.
It makes me think of all the things that cults work extra hard to do, how they have to step up their game when something is so fundamental, or when like a connection between a parent and a child is so natural and fundamental. Then if they need to break that up, then they need to have it be that the parent is doing it for the child, or that there's some fear, some threat mixed into it. They do have to make it much more extreme or somehow benevolent, but they have to work hard at it because these connections are quite natural, but also being connected to yourself, to your own mind, to your own internal dialogue is so natural. So that's so interesting. So here with this mind rape.
You know, it's interesting. After I wrote my first book and then talked to some fellow survivors who were like, yeah, you were always in your own little world with your head down, like writing in an imaginary notebook. I wonder if this, my neurodivergency and building worlds in my mind and writing, was something that helped me be less programmable or something.
I wonder if it's something that was done even subconsciously so that you were less programmable, or just that you have this nature, which makes you less programmable. Either way, it worked in your favor. And it's wonderful that you actually do get to write down words now, and it's not imaginary. It doesn't have to be in a fictional way. That's lovely. I love that.
That's for real. Let me show you this thing that I made. So it's a shirt that I make with two squares of fabric and then knitted sleeves. And I call it the 2x2s because, you know, there's a famous cult called the 2x2s, but also I think it's the buddy system. It's a brainwashing tactic.
Wow. Yeah.
All of my products get culty names. This is the love bomb collar. And then I send you a fact sheet about love bombing and how to avoid it.
Oh, that's so great. I love that. I was thinking maybe you made that because it's very cool. The 2x2 idea, yes, there is a cult called the 2x2s. So many abuse stories have come out of that group and are continuing to come out. We've had a couple of former members and couples on the show talking about it and how they really devoted themselves now to fielding people's stories where they're talking about what happened to them in the group, which is quite a benevolent thing to do, to want to take all that on, to be a resource for other people. One of the things that I try to encourage people to do is to ask why. So it's interesting you were talking about children asking why. If someone says you can never be alone, always having someone with you, you want to ask why, and you don't want to take their answer as the answer, because it will always be somehow for you, but it's for them, not for you. So sometimes when people are trying to figure out why they're being controlled and what's happening, I'll have them, if they can, switch the pronoun, the person they're doing it for, in their minds, because it never works for you, but it always works for the controller, even though it's presented as being for you. That seems pretty static, standard.
So I have a really crazy example of this, but when I was deployed in 2011, the Army had very strict rules about no sex, no sex on deployment. And the way they enforced that was by saying a male and a female could not be alone together in a room or in anything that acted like a room, like a bunker or an office. And they said it was about operations, only for operations, because we can't have pregnancies, because then we just can't. But then, interestingly enough, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed in the middle of the year. And the way the top brass just went crazy, being like, but then how are we going to keep the boys and boys and the girls and girls? And I remember just 24-year-old me, I'm just watching, thinking, yeah, so it was never about operations. It was always just a purity requirement of like, war is hard, no sex. And it was about control, and you're under surveillance more, and everyone's watching each other, and you get this, it's my favorite name term that I found in cult studies, performative regulation. Horizontal form of control where everyone's watching everyone else, and also you're keeping yourself under control. When I tell you, because of this ban on sex, from the time I left my room in the morning to the time I got back to my room at night, everyone was watching all of the time because there weren't very many women. And so they were like watching you, and constant surveillance is how we break people.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah, good example of just what you were saying about you can't listen to the group that you're trying to assess's explanation of their rules.
Yeah, I mean, I have that with people I talk to who are raised Jehovah's Witness. So if they leave, the parents are supposed to disconnect from the children, to shun them for their sakes. I've heard of a number of families who find a way around that, really miss their children, want to connect with them. The children, or whoever the people are in the family who left, notice that they have an impact on the people who are still in. And so I'm sure the leaders knew that, because it starts to break down once you start to see that you're told that your child is going to become a sinner, and they're actually really great kids, and they didn't need this in order to remain good kids.
And I think part of what happened with Children of God was the internet killed off their isolation. For me, growing up, my mom was 15 when she had me, but I was the age of the end of those big families. The first kids of the second generation grew up, like my mom, grew up in complete isolation from the rest of the world, only experiencing these communes, plus whatever performing and work they did in public. But by the time we were coming up, the early internet had started. The Children of God wanted to jump on that and use it for their business, for sales, for marketing, for blah, blah, blah. But then they sort of inadvertently gave us more connection to the outside world. Specifically, my mom didn't even pretend to shun me when I left. And people just weren't even doing it anymore because everyone was in contact with their kids, or knew someone who was still in contact with their kids. And I wouldn't say that most of us were doing fine on the outside, but I do think the isolation evaporated for them there a little bit.
So fascinating. I wonder also, and I was thinking about this the last time we talked, and there wasn't enough time to bring up everything, but I was thinking about this question that I'd love to bring up now, and then I want to make sure that we have more time to talk about your book and what you're doing and how people can reach you. But just about a relationship to the self, to the body. When people sometimes leave situations where they couldn't have any kind of boundary, they will then sometimes learn karate, taekwondo, other self-defense, because they need to be able to almost have muscle memory to know that they can protect themselves if they're being attacked, and that they have the right to do that, and they have the right to set up perimeters. When you go into the army, I haven't been in it, but it is, I think, so much about you becoming a person who can rely on your body, on yourself, to protect yourself, to protect others. And so I'm just wondering if that shifted a relationship that you had with yourself by going into the army, or if it felt similar in some ways.
So I would say both mind and body, yes. I had never thought about it quite this way with my obsessive running in the army. I knew that that was a trauma response, but the whole feeling in your body and knowing what you could do with your body was very, very important to me, I think. And I'd never really had that before. I pretty much immediately after joining, like, quit chain smoking to join the army, and then pretty immediately became kind of like a super runner. A lot of that was cult trauma, like, no, I'm going to be the best at whatever they tell us to do, and I'm just going to push myself and not listen to my body. But there was definitely a part of it that it was nice to be good at something, and it was something physical and something that the organization liked. There were so many aspects to it. And then mentally, too, something that I worked out in therapy was that growing up under threat all of the time, and then going into a job where you are in charge of analyzing the threat, is my brain's way of dealing with that. And it is still very much part of what I do now. Like, here's something scary on the news, and I immediately go into, break that down. What does that look like? What are the logistics? Both survival strategies, I think.
Yes. And I'm wondering also about physiologically, do you find yourself shifting your breathing, or what do you do just to keep in a calmer state?
Well, I mean, I think I craft for 12 hours a day, and I'm pretty consistently knitting or crocheting, and that has so much connection with healing and with being embodied. I have a sauna that, with anxiety, I've learned either I need to work out or I need to go hot shower or hot sauna. And then I really like dance too. And often it'll be dance with my kid. And we even have a screaming spot in the woods nearby where the train passes by. And then we just scream as loudly as we want to. And that helps us with a lot of the powerful body feelings as well.
That's so nice. It's so nice also with having a daughter who you're teaching where it's okay for her to be loud. I love that. That's really nice.
There was two moments. This one time she was 1.5 years old, and she just walked over to the fridge and opened the drawer and started eating grapes. And I was like, I was 11 the first time I opened a fridge, and that was to cook dinner for everyone in the commune. Then one time she was about 3 at gymnastics, and they're all supposed to be going in a little line to the next station. And my daughter, as they pass the sponge pit, just decides she's going to throw herself in the sponge pit. And then another kid fell, and I just stopped myself from jumping out of the chair because I was like on my way to rescue her. And the teacher came over and was like, okay, friends, that's not what we're doing right now. Let's go. You know, it's just very nice. And I had to sit there and I had to be like, she's fine. Nobody's going to hit her, and you're not going to go home and hit her. It's fine. It has been very healing. Having a child definitely made me go a lot harder on my own healing journey and deconstruction journey for her sake. But it's also the end of my memoir. It's in the musical. It's like she is the do-over baby. She's the one that's not fourth generation cult. She was born into complete freedom and parents who are working on themselves. And we always say, like, the hardest thing about parenting her is she doesn't have a good little soldier mode to snap into, because we didn't train her into one. On hard days, I just look at my husband and I'm like, imagine trying to raise her in a cult. And that was me. She's a wonderful person who is her own person from scratch.
I love that idea, own person from scratch. I see that a t-shirt that she could wear. I'm my own person from scratch.
She didn't breathe for 7 minutes, which was incredibly traumatic. But I swear it's because nobody asked her if she wanted to be born, and she had not quite agreed. And she has been that person from day one. And it's wonderful.
I love that. I love she's still kind of undecided. Let me think this through for a sec.
It's everything cults try to make you afraid of. If your children are not these perfectly controllable, perfect beings, they're going to grow up and be awful. And people literally sacrifice their children to this idea that they're helping them. And instead of, no, she's a great, we don't use a lot of punishment. She's thoughtful and kind and also wild and witchy and her own person from scratch.
The whole idea of her being awful. Again, going back to this idea, who is she going to be awful for? Because so many of these cults are run by people who need total control because they can't handle if anyone is going rogue. It somehow means something about their power that they can get everyone to be these sort of ducklings in a row. If your daughter's doing her own thing and she's threatened with, or you're threatened with, that she's going to grow up and be awful, I hear, oh, a cult leader is saying, it would be awful for me, or it would look awful for me to have someone do their own thing who I don't have total control over because I have such a fragile ego that I cannot handle people doing their own thing. And I also don't know how to have connection with people. I only know how to have power over people. So I need people to do as I say.
I think that reframe is so important. When I was 24 years old, I was already an officer in the army deployed to war, and I went on R&R to Australia, and where I ran into some folks that had known my family and the children of God. And one of them says to me, hey, how come your mom's kids were always so much trouble? And I sort of did exactly what you said. I said, excuse me, look at where I am right now with my life. And you're not in the cult anymore. You know it was a cult. Can we maybe redefine whether I was trouble or not?
Or maybe I had that independent spirit that helped me rescue myself. That is interesting.
I just think that's part of the healing that having a kid can do. And I think we all question sometimes whether we should have had kids because of the trauma we bring into it. Or at least I know I do. But I get to realize I was not a bad kid in a whole different way. And I get to like learn about kids and children in a whole different way because we didn't really have childhoods at all.
I think being a parent too, you want to believe, and I think it's true, that you don't have to be perfect at it, whatever that means. I think that you want to have enough growth and enough humility to be able to apologize and acknowledge and be accountable. But also, I think kids really love being able to see how you are not going to just fall into intergenerational traumatic behavior and abusive behavior just because, that you can say, I'm not actually going to repeat that. I could have yelled at you. I could have punished you for this, but instead, I'm going to do this differently, not perfectly, differently. And I think kids love to see that it's they're worth that, you shifting how it's being done.
It's great. Yeah. I do think ending the generational trauma is important work.
It's important work, right? But you're going to have a react, like with the ball pit, she just went for it, which is delightful. And you're panicking and horrified. Oh, no. And hearing somebody say, okay, friends, I love that. It's so perfect. Okay, friend. The reframe is, it isn't necessary to punish. This is an opportunity for teaching and for accepting and for guiding and for all the other more gentle things that can happen in those moments, because it's not about right or wrong. It's about something being an opportunity for growth, which is how a lot of the world is. And you just don't believe it at first. You need to kind of get a lot of proof of it over and over again.
That's for sure. One of the things I always tell very young teenagers who are sometimes still in their family cults is you hold on and you just remember that the world isn't as bad as they're telling you that it is. And that's hard because we do really struggle on the outside, the way that the cults told us that we were going to sometimes. But one of the things I realized writing my first book was I was like taking off all this armor to write the book. And then I was like, oh, maybe I didn't need as much of this armor in the first place. But I sort of did it because the cult had told me that the outside world was really mean and awful and bad.
If you've spent a lot of time developing this armor and you feel like it has served you in the past, you don't want to lower your weapon until you know there's no threat. But at what point do you start to believe that? Or do you need to believe there's no threat? Or do you need to just know that if there were, you would respond to it, but you don't need to be at the ready all the time? What do you think?
So that's definitely the point of the intelligence officer's job. There's always this point where you realize that it doesn't actually matter what scenario you give them, because the point is the preparation. The point is knowing that you've thought through the scenarios, you know what your responses would be, because the emergency is never going to be what you expect it is. It's never going to go exactly the way it's gone before. Knowing that you have the skills, I've been telling my audience that a lot recently, that a lot of people who grew up under authoritarian control are triggered and anxious right now. I think it's a good exercise to remember. I survived the craziest stuff as a 5-year-old. I would be better at surviving it this time around. I've had specific conversations with my anxiety as far as I have this thing where if my husband and child are not home the exact minute they're supposed to be home, I just know that they're dead and the cops are already on the way. And so I will have to talk myself through. My conclusion is no amount of preparation would prepare you for that. So maybe just don't go into panic mode. Like, even if it's true, enjoy your last 5 minutes of peace. And then usually they come home in 30 minutes and everything's fine. And I for sure know that the first part of that is PTSD from my youth. Every time we got in a car, we laid our hands on the car and asked God not to essentially kill us in a bunch of gruesome ways. I have a lot of different things linked, plus war, plus husband was a helicopter pilot. But the ability to sort of rationalize with myself has always been, I think, helpful for me.
Really helpful. Oh my goodness. I think it's probably a challenge also, though, to remind yourself to do it in the moment and to say, no, I actually need to have a convo.
Yeah, and it definitely can be. I talk about, so I was the intelligence officer for helicopters, and then I married a pilot. I was an expert on how he could die, and I was home with a baby, and he was deploying with special operations. So I had a plan of how everything was going to go. That's how I prepared myself, what I would do, how I would take care of the baby, all of that. But the one time I got a phone call that said, dead pilot, but took 2 minutes to tell me, not my pilot, everything went out of my head. Most of my military experience, most of my plan for what I would do, because you're just in sort of this suspended world. Going back to military and disaster preparedness theory, you prepare with that in mind. You prepare for the fact that everything changes as soon as bullets start flying. So you prepare more so that you have that muscle memory, essentially, for what you're going to do in the actual hot seat.
I still think they should have led with that in the conversation.
I agree.
Like, okay, thanks for making me wait 2 minutes of my life I can't get back.
Part of that is because they don't do notifications by phone, and they tell you that in your spouse briefings. And I knew that from being an Army captain. But again, it can all go out of your head.
Oh, yeah. Time goes so fast when we talk. I would love for you to let people know about all that you're doing. I love just how much you are involved in so many different things, in different creative projects, intellectual projects, all of it, all simultaneously. And creating while we're talking, which is amazing to do so many things at once. But I think your mind works in that way that you can just create so much all at once, which is really fantastic. People then are going to want to know a whole bunch from you about your book, about the musical, about your knitting and crocheting. And where can people contact you or find out about all this?
So I am a content creator called Knitting Cult Lady, and you can find me on pretty much any platform of your choice under Knitting Cult Lady. I'm very active on TikTok and YouTube and Instagram and Facebook. I knit and I break down bad guys and cults and coercive control, and it's a wild time to be an expert on the bad guys. We are like deconstructing cults and knitting ourselves back together and creating great fashion pieces and jewelry. So yeah, you can pretty much come find me on social media. I have two books, which is Uncultured, it's my memoir, and Culting of America, which is my cult tactics book, plus the workshop. Both of the books are also on audio. You can get them on Spotify Premium if you subscribe or anywhere else. And the musical is in the works. So we are trying to figure out how to make this musical that already has its little sort of cult following, but not make a cult. So it's going to be a fun project. And there's a lot of energy. Everybody wants to exist. You can catch me performing the songs on my channels.
Wow. And so just as we are finishing up, I know we talked just a tiny bit about organizational psychology. There's so much right now, you're right, that we can learn about how organizations work, about how people are within them, and about how they also go awry based on who's running them. And just to leave us with something that you think is really good for people to watch out for, how they know something that might have even started with the quote-unquote right philosophy or right meaning, but that the person in charge is taking it to a darker place. How would people know? What do we need to watch out for?
I think it's always going to be the cracking down on questions. Information is never bad. Cracking down on questioning is a warning sign. And one more is just the claim that we are the one, the way, the truth, life. I'm always very clear that I'm not the knitting cult lady. I'm just knitting cult lady, because calling yourself the is culty. No one is the world's biggest superstar. Nobody is all of these things that these gurus claim to be. The only one that has had an idea, the only one working on a thing. So this claim that like we're the only ones, I think is also a big warning sign.
That's really good. Yeah. It's funny because when I was thinking of what to call the podcast, I was thinking, well, for sure, I'm not calling it the Rachel Bernstein Show. I think that we're going to be allergic to certain ways of presenting ourselves in the world. And I think that humility is helpful and healthy and a lot of good things. But I love that you are making a mark and that you're teaching people and you're connecting people like knitting and having people create something together that is in a new form for them and for their lives. It's really wonderful.
I appreciate it. And I'm having a lot of fun in the interdisciplinary world, just bringing things together.
So nice. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I can't wait to be able to talk to you again when the musical comes out and we can do a whole song and dance. And it should be very, very exciting. It was a total treat. And I'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much.
One more thing before you go. Thank you to Daniela for imparting a lot of wisdom on us. It is so good to hear someone talk about how they've really come through the fire, actually two different fires that she talks about. And she's so capable and so busy doing a lot of really wonderful work. She started to talk about organizational psychology. And so I just wanted to take a few moments to talk a little bit about what that is. It is an interesting idea where people who are involved in organizations, in groups of any sort, can find that there is a whole either personal psychology, social psychology involved in it. It also sometimes answers the question why capable, sometimes independent thinking or intelligent people conform in groups or conform under pressure. One of the first concepts we come across a lot is this idea of groupthink. It's when the group prioritizes harmony and loyalty to the ideology over critical thinking. You need to somehow have conformity more important than anything else. So dissent becomes dangerous. And then members themselves self-center because they make sure that they're not thinking kind of outside the box in the group, or they are sure they're going to be thinking the wrong way. So consensus becomes artificially manufactured and made very important. It gives the illusion also that, quote unquote, everyone believes this, or everyone is of the same kind of thinking. So if you're not, what's wrong with you? Then there's cognitive dissonance. This is very purposeful. It's a psychological discomfort that happens when behavior and beliefs conflict. In controlling groups, people actually will justify abuse by saying, well, I've already sacrificed so much, or I don't want to admit that I'm being manipulated. My suffering must mean something. Often you're given compliments and kudos for being willing to suffer. The more someone sacrifices money, reputation, relationships, sleep even, or autonomy, the harder it becomes to leave. This kind of explains why people double down. Even after there's a failed prophecy, like the end of the world is supposed to come and then it doesn't, people will still double down. This kind of sunk cost fallacy. I've already given so much. I've already told people this is the best thing. I've already committed to this or committed to this community. They will also defend the leaders for this reason, even after the leaders might have been abusive or neglectful towards them. And then there is the obedience to authority. We see that time and time again. The social identity theory, we talked a little bit about that, but this idea that people derive self-worth from group belonging, from having a shared identity, having then shared status in the world, like we feel superior to other people because we have the answer, or sense of connection, which gives you also sometimes a sense of meaning when you have community. I now am feeling committed to this idea because, look, it's provided me with a whole community, a whole new family. And that people also love the idea of certainty. And if everyone else in the room feels a certain way, you think you can be certain about it too. Could be that you're all wrong because the leader is wrong, or that you feel special. There's so many concepts, but I'll keep it short. Then you have the learned helplessness. After repeated failed attempts to change the outcomes of a situation that you're in, people stop trying. They just sit back. And even if they're experiencing contradictory rules, impossible standards, moving goalposts, punishment regardless of how much effort and sacrifice they've made, eventually, initiative collapses, dependency increases, and self-trust erodes. And then there's the incremental commitment, the foot in the door idea. Manipulative systems rarely begin with extreme demands. You don't start often where you end up. And you don't commit to something that it ends up being. You commit to what it was as presented at the beginning. And you're willing then to make small favors, make small donations, go to extra meetings, cut one or two people out of your life who they say are not good for you, increase more of your personal disclosures to the leader, increase your isolation, and go along with some loyalty tests. Over time, they increase. And then there's the whole idea of the charismatic leader. There's so much to this. And the reason it's important to talk about is it shows how anyone can succumb to any of these things. There's a reason they work, and there's a reason they work almost uniformly and across the board around the world. Thank you so much. for Daniela bringing this idea to our attention. I'm going to speak more about it in a bonus episode for our Patreon supporters. So definitely go to patreon.com/indoctrination, where I'll get more into all of these concepts. And I wish Daniela well with all of her wonderful and exciting work in the future and with her book coming out. Really lovely. I'll talk to you all next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
Are you healing from manipulation, narcissistic abuse, or coercive control? I created something for you. It's called the Restore Journal app. Built from my decades of experience helping survivors recover, this trauma-informed app is more than journaling. It's a guided healing space to help you process what happened, reconnect with your voice, rebuild self-trust, and create healthier boundaries for the future. You can move at your own pace through all of the sections. And it's a multimedia healing support designed for different learning styles and needs. There are 3 tiers, including one that offers you full access to my video and audio library. If you're ready to feel understood, supported, and move forward with more clarity and strength, the link for the app is in the show notes. Take good care.